Hallo Tunes Live luisteraars. Tunes Live is 'n stroom van geselsies wat ek voer met plaaslike musisi en plaaslike musiekindustrie rolspelers. Tunes Live is 'n voortspruitsel vanuit Tunes Studio. Ek is Jean Marais. Tunes Studio is 'n rehearsal space in Stellenbosch wat musiekverwante dienste bied soos rehearsal space, recordings, live sound, die retail van musiekprodukte en bekomstighede sowel as musieklesse. Tunes Studio het onlangs begin om 'n professioneel toegeruste opnamefasiliteit te bou en binnekort in die maand van April gaan ons 'n paar recordings begin doen. Ons gaan nie nou al vir julle vertel wie ons gaan record nie. Nader na die tyd sal ons 'n bietjie meer inligting oor dit vrystel. Maar gaan kyk gerus op ons webwerf www.tunestudio.co.za. Daar kan jy meer lees oor ons recording fasiliteit en kom besoek dit gerus en bel ons, e-mail ons en kom kyk wat ons daar doen. En binnekort sal ons ook vir julle samples hê om na te luister. Op verlede week se show het ons gepraat met Jorik, oftewel Jori Pienaar. En Zildjian Suid-Afrika was 'n sponsor gewees vir daai show. En daar was 'n kompetisie uitgeloods waar jy 'n hamper kon wen, 'n Zildjian hamper of 'n gift pack, wat ook al jy dit wil noem, 'n geskenkpak. So, daar was 'n man by name Eugene Kraamwinkel. Hy is die ou wat, hy is die gelukkige wenner van hierdie hamper. Hy het vir my 'n baie nice e-mail gestuur oor hoekom hy spesifiek baie van Jorri se episode gehou het. En wat hy sê, dra definitief baie krediet. Hy sê dat drummers is die kern van 'n band, maar hulle kry tog baie min recognition. En iemand soos Jorri is, ek meen, hy is a legend en hy het al verskriklik baie goeders gedoen in hierdie scene en vir baie mense gespeel en speel nou nog vir baie mense. So ja, daai is 'n baie nice e-mail. Thanks Eugene. Ek sal vir jou 'n mail stuur om jou besonderhede te kry en dan stuur ek vir jou daai Zildjian hamper. Dit hy bevat 'n Zildjian cap, 'n Zildjian bottle en 'n Zildjian hemp. Vandag op die show het ons 'n virtuoso gitarist. En sy naam is Richard Pryor van die Boulevard Blues en van Pillman, daai supergroep wat hy gevorm het saam met Jesse Jordan en Kevin Gibson en as ook sy basspeler Robbie Stemmet. Hulle is Pillman. So as jy Afrikaans is of jy sukkel om Engels te verstaan, moet jy dalk terugkom na 'n volgende onderhoud toe, want hierdie ene is in Engels. So geniet die of bear met die Engels. Ons sal vir jou spoedig weer 'n Afrikaanse onderhoud bring. Voordat ons verder gaan en voordat ons begin luister na wat Richard Pryor vir ons als te vertel het, moet ek net dankie sê vir die EMDC Stellies, wat 'n kollektief is wat weekliks by mekaar kom in Stellenbosch om musiekwerpe te bespreek. Hulle doen onder andere album, genre en kunstenaarbesprekings met dikwels quiz en movie nights tussenin gegooi. Vergaderings is gratis en geen instrumentale vermoëns of kennis van die betrokke onderwerp is nodig om by te woon nie. Vind gerus meer uit van die EMDC Stellies deur hulle friend request te stuur op Facebook. Right, nou kan ons lekker terugsit en luister na die lekker stories van Richard Pryor. En hy is 'n man wat al, hy speel al vir 20 jaar vir Boulevard Blues. So daar's 'n klomp interessante dinge. Hy vertel ons onder andere van hulle record label en van toere in Engeland en al sulke goeder. So sit terug en enjoy. Sien julle volgende keer. Wow. Record, eh?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
Ah, some beatboxing. Yeah. Lekker. Sure. Dude, where were you born?
I was born in Cape Town. It's Jean, eh?
Yeah. It's not that. It's not Gene Tunes America.
Not Gene Tunes. Jean, I was born in Cape Town, yeah.
Okay, where in Cape Town?
Well, at a place called Vincent Pilotti Hospital, which is quite close to Pinelands.
And where did you grow up?
In Cape Town. In
okay.
Mostly Pinelands.
Yeah.
And then my second city was East London.
Okay.
A lot of family there.
Did you stay there for like high school? And
well, we went there often. We would go there like twice a year.
And yeah.
My mom's got a big Lebanese family that stayed in East London.
Okay. That's pretty interesting. Lebanese, you say.
Yeah, so my mom is like full on Lebanese. Well, all her grandparents are from Beirut.
Okay, hectic. And
so
from,
she can cook.
Ah, and from your dad's side?
What's he's the, actually from Windhoek. He was
okay.
born in Windhoek. And then he came out here when he must have been about 12 or so. Went to school, Maris Brothers School in PE somewhere.
Okay.
So that's how they were.
Eastern Cape boy kid.
Yeah.
When did you kind of, what was your musical awakening? And like, tell me more about that. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, I've always loved music. And I always connected, I always had songs going. But never really got serious about it until I was a teenager.
Okay.
But we did have a guitar hanging around the house, and I used to fiddle with it. And
Since what age?
You know, I must have been about 8 or 9, there was a classical guitar that I could fiddle with.
Yeah.
And didn't really take it too seriously, though. I was more of a listener, but I tinkered along. And then finally, getting into the teens, I started taking it really seriously, and then realized that what I want to do is actually play this thing.
But that's an interesting point you're making now. You said you're more than a listener, because that's a really, really solid foundation. If you listen to music, you have to. We're still going to get to that, but I've heard that you teach as well. Do you still teach guitar?
I still teach.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because I teach, I've got a few students for drums as well, and what I always tell them is, listen, it's your best weapon. Like, go out and listen to as many and as diverse as lots of styles of music,
sure.
You know. So yeah, very interesting point that I just wanted to kind of emphasize. You said you're a listener, and that's obviously where your palate, your musical palate, kind of
sure.
expand. You said you started jamming seriously in your teens. I read somewhere that you're hectically into Sabbath and Priest, Judas Priest and Black
Absolutely.
Sabbath. With who did you jam? Did you have any jam partners in high school? Any bands? Any vibes?
There wasn't much. I was a little bit of an island musically.
Hectic.
And there wasn't much going on. This was, you know, 19...
Thanks, Wes.
Cool.
You know, early 80s. But I did, I got into the heavier side. I first got into the Police, a bit of Queen, and then Black Sabbath.
Okay.
Judas Priest.
Yeah. What's your favorite Priest album?
I think my favorite Priest album is probably Killing Machine.
Okay. I was going to, I thought you were going to say Painkiller.
No, it's the early stuff, man.
Yeah.
I got into Priest like
way before 90, yeah.
But Black Sabbath was probably the one that really got it going. And I actually only found out about Black Sabbath through Scope magazine.
Nice.
I was reading Scope, and right at the end they had the reviews. I think it was my dad's Scope magazine. And at the end they had the reviews of the records that had come out, and I saw Black Sabbath, Never Say Die, and I thought it looked pretty cool because the guys had these masks on, and it just sounded like something I would enjoy. So the next day I went out, caught a train into Golden Acre, and went to Ragtime Records and attempted to buy that album, but they didn't have it. All they had was Paranoid, so I ended up coming back home with Paranoid, and that was my awakening to metal.
Nice.
First part. And I continued that through my teens, being very much into metal.
It's interesting that
hard rock.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that album, Paranoid, because it's got the song Paranoid on, which is, according to Black Sabbath and some other people, a pop song, not actually a metal song.
Absolutely. Yeah. Their main number on that track, I think, on that album was War Pigs.
Yes. So did you learn the riffs quick? Did you play War Pigs and Paranoid and that
sure.
stuff?
Definitely.
After school, man, what was the vibes? Did you go to university? What did you do? Straight off school?
Yeah, no, I was a bit off the rails then, so I didn't have any. As I said, I didn't really have much clear idea of what I wanted to do. I just knew that I enjoyed playing guitar, so that's I played, and I ended up in the army.
Wow.
I had to go for my 2 years prescription.
Yeah.
Whatever.
How old are you now, man?
I'm 49.
Okay, so it's army era.
Army era. So yeah, that was a bad time. It was a dark time, me going from, I couldn't really play guitar.
Yeah.
I ended up in Kimberley, and I think I was a bit depressed, and eventually went AWOL. My music sort of, I don't know what happened there, but it was a bit of a time when I wasn't really playing. I was just trying to get out of the army, basically.
Yeah.
And then, after that finally finished up, then I got into doing some bands, some covers. We used to have function bands, but nothing specifically. I always wrote music.
Yeah.
Kept writing. I've always been a writer, but I never really got my stuff out there until much later.
What was your first band, like the first band lineup and like gigs and you know?
Yeah, the first stuff that I did wasn't really. I mean, there was another band we had called Time Out,
mm-hmm.
and we used to just do it really for money. So we used to learn a lot of songs, a lot of covers.
Yeah,
and I used to incorporate a whole lot of instrumentals that I wrote as well, and we used to play those. But we used to just add them in, you know.
Yeah. Ron, what year was this Time Out band?
In the 80s.
Early 80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Somewhere around.
Shit, that's even before I was born.
Okay.
Musical endeavors, okay, we were speaking about bands, but any musical endeavors / bands up until Boulevard Blues came, okay, I know that Boulevard Blues came a bit later in your career. Around what age did you get involved with Boulevard Blues?
I must have been about 29.
Okay, I was thinking
around
30.
There,
yeah.
30, 29, 30.
Okay.
But that's the only time, look, I would, and as I said, I was pretty much, I didn't give a damn.
Yeah.
I was just like a little bit off the rails. I was just rocking it up. Mm. But what I would do is still play. I still practiced, and I wrote songs. I wrote two instrumental albums.
Wow.
I kept writing, but I never put the stuff out there, and I never took it seriously as something to market. I'm very different now. I was in my 20s.
Yes.
So my 20s was like a bit of a shambles.
Did you have a feeling of, was there something that you were scared of putting your music out there? Because I know a thing with some artists, it's never done. They never want to put it out because they feel vulnerable.
Yeah.
When the stuff is actually out in the public, and they're like, so no, not going to release it. It's not good enough. No, I'm going to wait for the next batch of songs. You know, was there a fear like that with you?
Well, I never really followed the proper channels. All I knew, I just didn't get into that marketing side of things, and there wasn't really that sort of self-marketing opportunity back then,
yes.
like as there is now, where you just need to get on your horse and you need to market your stuff.
Yeah.
There you'd have to go through the proper channels of finding an agent and finding someone who's interested in your music. And, you know, it wasn't because I didn't want to put the stuff out there. I couldn't have been bothered. I just wanted to write the stuff and make it. And I felt very chuffed after I'd done it.
Mm.
There was no financial motivation.
And speaking financial motivation, in that time, we were kind of spanning over like 10 years now. What did you do for an income?
I actually, I did go to university after the
Army. Okay.
And I studied jazz studies for 3 years. After that, I did play in different cover bands, and I earned a bit of money there, and then I started teaching quite young. So when I was 25, I was already teaching.
Okay.
And that's... teaching was... I've been a teacher since I was 25.
Serious. So, and that's still today, that's your main source of income?
No, it's not my main source of income, but it is a source of income.
Yeah. So if we just jump a few years, what is then today your main source of income or your main focus?
It will be my main source of income is my gigs and my shows, which is up and down, you know. Some months it can be pretty crap, and you know, every now and again I get a little bit of a shot because something really worked out or the planets aligned.
So nice to have the lessons to kind of just get you through, just to fill it out.
I think what happened is if I'm concentrating very much on festivals or shows or trying to get gigs, then the students suffer a bit and they go down. Otherwise, if I've got a lot of students, I find I can't focus as much on gigs, and a bit of session work here and there.
Okay, cool. I was actually speaking to a young up-and-coming session drummer a while back, Werner van Waldschlieben, and he told me that it's actually like it sounds like paradise. He told me his gigs and his tours got too much, so he had to leave his students, he had to leave the school, you know. How cool is that, you know? My tour schedule is too hectic, I gotta... Because he said he started feeling bad for like you said, no, not getting to the students, not paying enough attention.
Yeah,
you know?
So basically, I mean, what I did is just, I didn't advertise or push it as hard, so it would slightly, I mean, I could manage a certain amount of students, no problem, but not like 20 to 30 a week.
No, because you gotta, it's a mindset as well, and it's sometimes preparation and all of that stuff.
Sure,
Now I'm thinking blues meets rock. You're very much involved. That's your endeavor, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me a bit more what I want to kind of get behind the quarry scene. You, Doc John, Mike Combrink, the kind of the organizers of that. How did you get Fender on board with blues meets rock?
Well, basically, blues meets rock is... I went from rock. I pretty much played rock until I joined Boulevard Blues. And when I joined Boulevard Blues, I was not a blues player. I actually started learning blues from that day onwards, pretty much. And I've been learning blues and getting more in touch with blues since then. So that was the point where I went from rock to blues, and I liked the blues rock side of things. So anything from blues and slightly blues rock music is where that place where they meet. That's so what I really got into, and I wanted to push that side of that genre of the music. And so doing my original stuff, Pebble Man, which is the rock side of things, and doing the blues thing, I just wanted to create a show that actually
did both.
But even before that, we did the Table Mountain Blues Summit. And Mike Crombrand started the very first one at the Tafelberg Tavern in town.
Yeah.
And
the Table Mountain Blues Summit is kind of the predecessor to
Blues Meets Rock.
Okay.
Yeah. So I didn't do the first one. We just played at it, and Mike, you know, he kept it going and ran at quite a huge loss. And everyone got paid. He paid everybody. The second year, I got on board and I brought Combustion Technology with me, and I brought
what is
Combustion Technology? Always helped my shows, and they put a little bit of money behind each show.
Okay, and so it's a kind of like a sponsor,
pretty much. I know the CEO, and he's passionate about blues.
Cool. Well, that's a very interesting kind of.
And I met him through guitar lessons. He came to me for guitar lessons.
Ah, cool. So you see, that's how the two helps each other, eh? Nice. Yeah. How did you get Fender on board? Are you endorsed by Fender?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, pretty much, Boulevard Blues was, when I joined, was another guitarist, Dale Collins.
Mm.
So he was the rhythm guitarist, and they needed a lead guitarist, and I played a Gibson then. And then when he left, I was the only guitarist, and a Gibson, for me, just didn't fit that mold.
Didn't cut it, yeah.
A Fender was just a wider
vibe.
It had the top end, the bottom end, it took up a nice...
What Gibson did you play?
I played the Les Paul Standard.
Okay.
And that's big and fat, but it's MIDI,
yeah.
And it's got a specific way of complimenting another guitarist.
Yeah, and but also for the blues, I mean, Fender, you know, it's
Fender's
sits.
Great just for that one guitar in the band.
Yes.
And so I approached Fender and I said, here's my stuff, and they really enjoyed it and digged it. So they said, yeah, cool.
That's how long ago is this now?
The Fender endorsement was about 2008.
Wow.
Somewhere around there.
Cool. And how does your endorsement work? Do you get like a Les 50 and, you know, for how did...
Yeah, lots of good deals. I get all my work done on my guitars, my amplifiers.
Mm.
I get giveaways to put into my shows.
Yes.
So I can... Fender will back them, and just having the support of them is it just adds a bit of weight to the...
Definitely.
To the show as well.
It keeps you relevant and it keeps them relevant. It's definitely a two-way street.
Yeah, so every time a blues meets rock show goes on, it's combustion technology and Fender that are actually putting it on. And lately Paul Bothner have been very kind as well, so they put up some vouchers. And
okay, cool. Who do you deal with at Paul Bothner?
Carl.
Okay, so I know Carl van Heerden,
And he's been good to local music as well.
He's a great guy. He understands. We were actually speaking about him in an interview that's still coming, so I'm not going to mention who the interview it is, but we spoke about Carl, and one thing that really surfaces for me about Carl is he understands the passion, he understands music, but he's very business driven, and he's very, and rightfully so, he's a very, very driven guy.
Sure.
But he's got a heart, you know. It's not all about, you know, the corporate and all that.
I guess you need both.
You do. It's a very, very nice balance.
Sure.
So with Blues Meets Rock, you obviously one of the main organizers. Who helped you organize the events?
The Blues Meets Rock, I just do on my own.
You just do it on your own.
That's my stuff.
Okay.
So it's pretty much, I run a monthly show.
Yeah.
And then I was running a festival once a year, a big Blues Meets Rock festival, which the last one I did was with Dan Pedlensky's album launch in 2016, which was a huge concert. It was really nice for the blues anyway.
Mm.
But I just found that was just too stressful to do and take the risk, financial risk.
The event is too big.
Well, just for me to do it, I've been doing the Tabman Blue Summit and that, and taking huge financial risks doing it. And if somebody could have said, Richard, we'll take the financial risk away, and you just go ahead and do the show and make sure it's a success or whatever, then it would be much easier. But to actually have to be responsible for all the money.
Yeah.
And all the debts. That was too stressful to continue. So I don't do the big shows anymore unless somebody comes on and says, we'll put up the money, you go and do your work, you know?
So if I think now, one thing that really startled me is you guys throw triple bills with Jesse, Albert, and Boulevard Blues. It's heavyweights, man. How do you actually, and this maybe ties in with combustion technology coming on board, but how do you actually, you know, pay that three bands through the door, paying sound, doing marketing, paying the door people, maybe venue hire, artists?
It's a lot, yeah.
You know, how do you club that overheads and still, I mean, Albert, all this, you guys are all professional, you want your slice of the cake after the gig, like how do you, you know, how does it work?
Well, it pretty much works on door taking, so we've got to get the people in.
Yeah, so how many, like with a quarry show, with the average quarry show, how many people do you get through the door?
Well, I mean, for the monthly Blues Meets Rock, we can get anything from 150 to 300.
Wow, yeah, that's people. Decent. So,
so we need, and for a show with Albert, obviously you're going to need a bit more. Maybe the price will be a little bit higher.
Yeah.
So you're looking at 250 minimum.
And then how much per ticket?
And then we're looking at 100 rand a ticket, or 120 rand a ticket.
You can cut it.
And also, you know, if we use Jesse, Jesse's part of my band, Pebble Man.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So we may do Pebble Man and Albert.
Yeah.
And then maybe we'll bring Doc John in as a guest. So
mix
the Pebble Man will have lots of maybe guests. And then, or maybe it's Boulevard with Jesse guesting. Or it could even be what we've done before is Albert joins and we back Albert.
Yeah.
He may do a solo show in the second part of the set. He would come in and we'd back him for a few songs, but generally I really like his trio, so that's when Albert Frost is firing at
shining
top.
For sound, because sound is expensive for shows, do you guys have somebody that kind of give you a good rate, people that you
I
use?
Do. Mostly I've got Ari Tablanche.
Okay.
And he runs the sound side of things.
Okay, and he obviously comes in at a good rate because you book him a lot.
Well, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, for the Blues Meets Rock shows, he knows that, I mean, for any of those shows, I book him first and foremost. So. And he works with Duck Charles at the Barnyard, so he's working every day there.
Yeah. Speaking of the northern suburbs and of the blues scene there, why do you think is there such a strong, vibrant blues scene and people actually supporting the blues scene in the northern suburbs, you know, the Durbanville Golf Club, all those type of gigs? Why do you think is that? Why?
Well, I don't know if anybody else is offering, just, you know, people offer covers, they offer Led Zeppelin tributes, they offer lots of different band tributes, they offer covers. And then just normal bands, but I don't think anyone's really offering a blues show or blues rock show. And it's not a huge market, but it's a niche market, and some people want to see blues music and they want to see on stage jamming and maybe a collab here, something that could happen once off as well, you know. It could be impromptu jam or something, you know.
You know, it's interesting for me about that is like blues being a working class genre. People in the working class has played the blues, and in a scene like Durbanville, or not specifically Durbanville, but the northern suburbs area, people being wealthy there, a bit more of older people, you know, people that's got kids and families going, and it's interesting that blues kind of gets absorbed by that portion of demographics, you know.
Yeah.
And it's actually a working class genre, like the gigs you guys do there in that area is really prestige events, you know.
Unfortunately, it hasn't been representative. Blues hasn't really taken off for the wider population.
Yeah.
I'm not really exactly sure. And I know jazz is pretty big, obviously hip-hop.
Well, again, that's demographics, I would say.
Yeah, but the blues, where the blues actually started was really for the poor people, so they could forget their worries.
Exactly.
And so they would play their blues and they would listen to it and they'd talk about pain and misery and that through the blues and the lyrics, you would forget for a while, and a bit of alcohol, you'd forget about your troubles and woes. But that music now, through it's meant to uplift, it seems to have moved to the people that don't have as much.
Exactly.
Pain and suffering.
Yeah, exactly.
It seems like
once
you've got to a certain sort of level of financial success or whatever, you seem to enjoy the blues a lot more.
That is what is interesting for me.
Interesting,
Very interesting.
And it's not, I don't think it's just a South African thing, although maybe a little bit more, but even in America, the blues is big amongst the middle to upper white audience.
Very interesting phenomenon. It's actually something that one can think and elaborate a bit more. Speaking up the creek, we're sitting at the creek, so we might as well speak about that. You guys played 8 consecutive years.
Well, I think we played 7.
7? Between 23 and 2010?
And I think there was one a year that Up the Creek didn't happen.
Serious?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I can't really remember, so I don't know all the details, yeah. But I think there was a sponsorship thing. Savannah pulled out, and it may have been for 2 years. I don't know.
Shit. Okay.
So there was, we played, and then there was this gap.
Yeah.
I think it was just 1 year. But we played about six or seven, and then this was probably our seventh or eighth. But I'd have to go back to the records to really see.
It's about that.
Yeah.
Okay, and how did things change for you in that time period, in that 6 or 7 years that you played Up the Creek? How did the festival vibe change? Anything that you can put your finger on there?
How do you mean, to now?
No, not to now. In between 23, after 2003 and 2010, that you guys played here a lot.
It did grow, that's for sure.
Definitely get bigger. Got bigger.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they still, they weren't really. I think now there's a different vibe. I mean, they're
definitely
trying to get the younger market.
Definitely.
They're trying to go on the howler system. So they're sort of going, they're modernizing quite a lot. But
yeah,
then it was always going to be a smaller festival, more intimate, slightly more for the family, and slightly older crowd.
Yes.
That was pretty much it, and it stayed pretty much like that for most of the time.
I could still check that last year about the older crowd, like 30 up. Upwards. But this year, not so much, man. It's really they're really getting the youngsters in, which is probably also a good thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean,
it's makes sense.
You don't want to get stuck, you know.
No.
So yeah, no,
pretty
it is
good, yeah.
Definitely a good thing. And now that you guys returned, obviously it changed a lot. How was it being back? How was your
No, it was pretty cool. I mean, it was great to be back.
Like,
it still felt very familiar. And coming past the Savannah stage, where the main stage used to be.
Okay.
That was quite,
I didn't know that.
That was where the main stage was, and there was a big like circus tent over that that used to house it. And we used to often do the Sunday morning slot as well.
Okay.
So we used to be come and have some blues.
Yeah.
At top was 10, 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
Shit, but then did you actually stay here for the whole festival and then play the Sunday
morning? Sometimes, but then we'd often arrive on the Saturday night.
Yeah.
You know?
No, that must be brutal, a whole weekend the festival and then you play the Sunday morning.
And I remember
shit.
We did the one slot before Taxi Violence.
Okay, because they also played like
they
6 or
Friday,
7
yeah.
Up the Creeks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's been cool, and I must say the sound is very good.
Yo, the sound here is always amazing.
Yeah.
What if you had to signal out the a show at Up the Creek that was like a really really nice one? What can you actually put your finger on one?
What, going back in the years?
Yeah, just like the best Up the Creek gig in terms of audience.
I think of the best. But I mean, I must say I enjoyed, I remember some of the Sons of Trout performances, even Bed on Bricks, Vonnebworm, when Sito used to run up and down the pole.
Golden years.
There was another band that I really enjoyed. It was called the African Rhythm Travelers or something.
I've heard of that. It's not the African Jazz Pioneers.
No, it was with Ashley Reed on drums.
Oh, yeah, that guy is insane.
And
I watched
played
him
really late, and I don't know, maybe I was just tripping at the right time or something, but it was just a very good, it was just everything about it was just so good.
Yeah.
Cool. And I was just watching that whole show, and I just thought, yes, that sounded great.
Ashley
African
Reed is a beast.
African Rhythm something. Oh, I'd have to look that one up.
Yes, that guy is a great drummer. I saw him at the festival in the West Coast first time like 2 or 3 years ago with Albert, and I was like, where the fuck does this guy come from? I've never heard of him, never checked him, and he's like, one of the greatest drummers in South Africa, in the world.
He's got a specific
very specific
style,
and also the way he uses the double kick pedal, like very very interesting way to play using his double kick pedal, but not in a metal way.
And he just grooves.
Yes.
Yeah, he's the groove master.
Now, But now also thinking, how is the acceptance of your gig last night in terms of earlier years? Because you had such a big gap, that's why I'm asking now. Well, how was, did it feel? You said you still felt at home. It still felt nice.
Yeah, look, whenever I get up on stage and I'm with my band, and you know, we kick in. We're like a family, and so we actually end up playing. We're not sitting there waiting for people to, I don't know, give us acknowledgement or anything. We're just going to play our stuff, and if you dig it, pull in and enjoy it, because we're having a good time playing it.
So. Yeah.
But it was a good crowd, and
it was a crowd. It,
yeah. And I mean, look, the first, you know, it's the first show of the whole festival, so it's got some sort of novelty.
Speaking Pebbleman now, you guys toured overseas, right?
No, I actually toured with Boulevard Blues.
You toured with Boulevard Blues, yeah. Okay. Tell me about that. How did you guys hook up?
We hooked up with some Dutch people, and they really, I mean, we're still good connections with them, and we, they just spoke about taking us out to Holland and Belgium, and so we went on.
Who's the, what are the names?
It was Jaap. Neil Dijk and a few other Dutch guys, some of his friends, and
are they sort of promoter guys actually?
Well, they run a business and they've got a business there, and they wanted us to come out and basically tour and also do their office, their corporate function as well.
Yeah.
And so they organized us a 14 gig tour over about 3.5 weeks in Netherlands and Belgium.
Around what time was that?
That was 2010. We were flying with all the Dutch World Cup losers in the plane. They were all depressed and morbid and on Prozac. And we had to drive. We had to fly back with them. So.
Yeah. And Pebbleman had a, if correct me if I'm wrong, there was a bit of a record deal going at a stage.
Yeah, we've still got a record deal there at Grooveyard Records.
Okay.
So basically, Pebbleman, I've done two albums. Pebbleman started a long time ago, and that was my outlet for original music. So I would sing, I'd do the bass, I'd play the guitars, I'd record it, I'd put it together, and I did two albums like that of Pebbleman. But those are my solo albums with me singing and everything. But then it wasn't really going anywhere, I was just doing it, and then I eventually wanted to get Jesse from a long time, because I've known Jesse since he was 20.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to connect with him. And finally, it was opportunity to say, Jesse, should we do Pebbleman? And he said, yeah, let's do it, man.
How did you get Kevin on board?
Kevin, I just sent him some of the material that I'd written, and he was quite interested in some of the prog side of it, because it wasn't just straight up and down music. It was pretty much,
there is definitely a broad feel.
You needed to learn it and play it, and I even said he learnt a lot from working the stuff out.
Coming from Kevin, that's
he said, I mean, I didn't believe him at the time, but he said, no, I've really learnt a lot from playing Pebbleman, because he hasn't really, I don't know if he's ever had a band where he can actually do that sort of stuff, because it's really inside of him. He's a 70s sort of prog rock drummer, and he can play all those intricate time signatures, because some of the early Pebbleman time signatures are intricate. Although we've tried to ease them up a little bit. But anyway, back to the albums. I just basically said to Jesse, you know, let's do this, and so we've since then recorded two albums with the band, and I've written the music specifically for Jesse's voice. I know where he's
his
range on the guitar, so I can feel, I can sound the notes out, and I wrote the melody lines and everything, and I would end up singing them and send them to him, and if he liked them, he'd keep them, and if he wanted to change them, he's welcome to. And then got hold of the stuff online as well, overseas.
Is that how Grooveyard happened?
Grooveyard, yeah.
Records, yeah.
By Joe Romagnola.
Okay.
In the US, and he really loved the stuff, and he wanted to produce produced the second album.
Where was the second album recorded?
Recorded here in West Coast Studios with Ari.
Okay.
And then it was helped produce by Joe overseas.
Okay.
He did the mastering side of things.
Yeah. And this record
and
deal...
All the artwork as well.
Okay. But this record deal with Grooveyards, I'm thinking now, is it a distribution deal?
Distribution deal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they don't do tours
sense,
or anything.
Yeah.
It's pretty much, he's got his market, Grooveyard Records, and they got a specific client base that
really
enjoys blues rock music.
And they print copies for you, you know?
They print them there.
Yeah.
Do everything. So they did the artwork, printed the CD.
Nice.
And they sell worldwide, yeah.
Do they also then work your online distribution?
They run the iTunes and
so
the
they,
CD Baby.
Yes, okay, cool. So they generate your ISRC codes and all of that. They do all of that stuff themselves.
They do.
That's amazing. Wow, because that's a shitload of admin.
Yeah, that is done quite seamlessly now these days.
Is it?
It's much easier to get all that stuff done.
Okay, yeah, I believe so. Somebody actually told me the other day they made it a bit easier.
Yeah, if you go through CD Baby or whatever, they'll do all that stuff for you.
Yeah. Are you, speaking of like Samro vibe, kind of vibes, are you like registered with Capasso and Samro and all of that?
No.
Not?
Not at all.
No. Not even with Samro?
No.
Wow, that's interesting.
Not at all. I've never received anything from Samro.
But yeah,
well, we shouldn't go there, really. I don't know.
Okay. Jumping back to teaching guitar, where do you teach from? How many students? What's the vibes?
Pretty much. I've got my studio at the back of my house. Not really a studio, but it's a teaching studio, and it's my cave.
Mm.
And
you also record there and stuff?
Well, not a lot, because neighbors complain and it's not
okay.
Soundproof, but it's my cave. I've got my sound equipment, everything there, and I've got teaching facility for my students, and they come through and they do a 45-minute lesson once a week, or sometimes they can do the power hour lessons.
Okay.
Anything from 5 students a month to 25 students students a week to 25 students a week.
Yeah.
It all depends on where I'm putting my priorities,
yeah.
You know.
And also depending on the students. But your students, is it kids, youngsters?
Yeah, I mean it used to be a lot more kids. I was getting a lot more kids, but now the kids have got in-house teachers or there's someone at the school. So I'm doing a lot of people that had maybe wanted to play guitar and work got in the way, and now they've got a little bit more time and a chance to just play the guitar for the pleasure of it. You know, the pressure's off. You don't have to be a rock star now or whatever. You can just enjoy the instrument, relax a bit.
Do you actually follow like a very structured course with your students, or do you just check where they are and kind of latch on?
Pretty much.
You send them in a direction, so you would check this oak is like really into jazz and you'd like kind of feed that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would see where the student is and then we'd move from there. I mean, I'd like to take them through certain information that I've got that I'd like to fast track them in, but we may go through slightly different pathways for each student depending on their likes and their level and how much time they've actually got to practice.
Yeah.
But it's very much, I just get the feel for it. I don't follow any structured course because that's a bit soul destroying.
Yeah.
I like to keep it open and quite improv.
It's very interesting that you say you kind of check the available time of the student to practice, because I experienced a big difficulty with that before with like kids that's coming back for the next week lesson. They just didn't work on the stuff. I'm like, okay, cool, let's go all over, we'll teach you this drum beat or this fill from scratch again.
No, that's something that I won't do. That's not fun.
No,
as a teacher
it really
so
sucks.
If the person doesn't do that work, we move on. But you can teach the same thing through another song or another lesson.
Definitely.
So you're just cooking up the same meal with slightly different ingredients.
Yes, That's very true. But what I found, like, this one kid, he's actually not with me anymore. It's a young kid, but he's super talented, man. That guy's going to be, soon he's going to be a better drummer than myself. But yes, man, it's just a struggle. Like, he comes back and he just didn't do his homework. But I know there's talent in this kid. Yeah. I know he's going to be a sick drummer, and it breaks my heart, really. Like, I must actually speak to his parents and get him to come back, because not in terms of like financial gain, but just because that kid really needs to play drums. He's going to be great one day.
Sure. Well, you know what? Being good and is in the mind a lot of the time. So you may have the technical ability, but your mind may not be there to take you much further. It all depends.
Maybe you just need a bit of a gap. Maybe if he comes back in a few years, his mind is
at
the right
place. There's some pretty... okay, talented drummers, but they've got their conscientiousness right up, and they've got the neurotic side of their life pretty sorted out as well. So if you've got all three of those things, you've got talent, you've got conscientiousness, and then you've got a low neurotic side, then you can get pretty far. Either one of those three is going to hold you back if you're not doing them.
Let's make it the conscientious sandwich.
Conscientious, yeah. I mean, that's practice, and that's wanting to do well, and that's making sure you do a good job.
The conscientious prior sandwich is what you need to have.
You need to have those three. And I mean, some people are not performers. They can get very good, but the actual performing side is quite scary. Getting on stage and playing can be quite scary for a lot of people.
Aldi Muli, I'm pronouncing it right.
Aldi Meola.
Aldi Meola, your favorite guitarist. Why do you like him so much? What about his playing?
I can't say he's my favorite guitarist, but he is the guitarist that I admire, because I will never play like Aldi Meola, and I have no desire to play Aldi Meola stuff. But it's so refreshing, because when I hear it, it's just... that's Aldi Meola, and he's... I just find his music is very, very sort of... it just encompasses so many world sounds. I mean, if you listen to some of his stuff, it goes from acoustic world symphonia to hardcore electric to Spanish guitar. He's got some incredible colors and palettes. The guy's sense of rhythm is second to none, being a drummer as well.
Okay.
So yeah, there's something incredible about Aldi Meola.
It sounds like he's got a very all-round feel and ability.
Yeah, he has, but it's also very specific. So when Aldi Meola plays, that's Aldi Meola.
Yeah, you can just hear it.
He's got a certain style, and he's not like a Guthrie, Govan, or one of those guitarists that can actually be anybody. Yeah, he's not a chameleon guitarist. He's Aldi Meola, very specific. But lately, I wouldn't say... I mean, as far as inspiration goes, I'm more into guys like Robin Ford and even another guy, Richie Kotzen, wonderful guitar player.
Yeah. Also a blues guy.
Yeah, well, he's become more blues.
Is it?
Yeah, as he's got older. He was actually rock a lot of the time. He was like a bit of a shred metal dude. He used to shred the hell out of his guitar. Now he doesn't even use a pick.
Yo.
He just uses his fingers.
How's that for a job?
He dropped it about 6 years ago. But still
never
ripping it up, but wonderfully in the blues sort of rock genre.
Yeah. More like an acoustic kind of onslaught.
Yeah, but still a very electric. He's got a telly.
Okay.
And then obviously Joe Bonamassa is a big influence as well. What he's doing and the blues stuff is incredible.
You had a pedal that you used last night. It's Wes, my friend. He actually named it because he's also a guitarist. He think he got it right. He's not sure, but it's like a very chorus sounding pedal. But it's not a chorus pedal. It just makes your guitar sound like almost like a stereo vibe to it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm trying to think if you are thinking of the Foxtron Octava, or you're thinking of the Phase 90. I don't know which one.
I'm not sure, but it's like it is a bit of a phasey effect, because it sounds like two tracks over each other, but there's a slight phase issue. But not an issue, but you know what I mean. There's like a slight phase that you can hear.
Yeah, I may have used it on the last song.
It was kind of all-encompassing. Well, it was kind of going through your whole set. You had that vibe on the tone.
Yeah, well, that must have been a sound thing.
I speak
to the sound guy. He did some magic there, man. Let's find out his tricks.
Dude, to your opinion, in what era was the best Strats made?
Well, I think it's a complicated question
because
I think some of the best Strats ever made are being made right now. There's no doubt about it. You're going to pay a premium price, but that was
Jaipur, USA.
Yeah, the USA they've got the custom shop Strats. You're not going to get better care and attention. In the early days, they weren't really that fussed about what they put together. But the thing is, those Strats are old, and you've got to. There's something to be said for old wood and old pickups, and just the fact that a guitar's been played and the vibrations have gone through that wood for 40, 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
It aligns that wood to a certain sound. The wood dries out.
Wow.
And you can get a new guitar, but it's never going to sound like a wood that's dried and played and got greasy and sat in the back of a car for 50 years. You're not going to get that. You can't do it. So those older guitars have mojo that the new ones don't have. But I think the attention to detail and the care for the expensive guitars is second to none now.
And then also, are you single coil? What do you, your pickup preference?
I mostly sit on the neck pickup.
Okay.
And that is a single coil.
Yeah.
And then, so it's two singles, and then I like to have the opportunity to go to a slightly
fat. Yeah.
A humbucker at the back. But then I'm happy. My HSS is great.
Okay, yeah.
And I've got four Strats, and they all end up like that. And I try and do something else, but as soon as I put a humbucker in, even a noise cancelling pickup, I just miss my single coil, whatever, Texas Special, or whatever's in there.
You said you had four different Stratocasters.
Yeah.
What are they?
Well, no one knows really, because I take the necks off and I just swap them around until none of my Strats have got their original necks. So I've got these four Strats, but they've all got each other's necks on.
Yeah.
And some of the Strats were cool, but that one red Strat sounded great with the black Strat's neck.
So
I took that neck off and I tried it on every single one of my Strats and wherever it sat best. And now they are quite happy with their necks now.
Other guitars?
Nothing. Oh, I've got an Ovation acoustic.
Okay.
So we do the acoustic blues band.
So you only have electric guitars, you only have Stratocasters?
Yeah.
Awesome. Wow.
I've got a bit of OCD, one track mind when it comes to that. And then we do the acoustic band, and then I use my Ovation.
Yeah.
Which is not my most preferred. One day maybe I wouldn't mind a more woody sound.
Yeah. So you went from Gibson and you're just like, cool, I'm sold. I'm just going to stick
with... Dale left the band, I was playing Gibson. I never really bothered with Fender. As soon as he left, I put my Gibson on Gumtree. It was sold within about 2.5 hours.
Crazy.
And that was it. I was back on the Fender. It was a bit of getting used to, but I'm not going back.
Yeah. And amp, what do you play?
I've got a couple amps. I've got the Dr. Z EZG 50, which I used last night.
Nice.
And then I've got maybe even more of a favorite is my JTM 45 hand-wired clone, Marshall clone.
That sounds
which
awesome.
Is great. I love it. I can turn it, it's a 30 watt clean amp, or they can get quite loud, but I can turn it up to 5 or 6 on the volume.
So it's got headroom for clean tone.
It's got a bit of headroom, nothing like the Dr. Z, Yeah. I mean, for a big stage, Dr. Z's got a hell of a lot of headroom.
So when would this amplifier, the last one you spoke about, when is the threshold for when the clean channel starts breaking up? Like 5, 6?
Yeah, four? On 5 it's great. After that it starts to break up.
Okay.
With single coils, with humbuckers it starts way before then.
Yeah.
But I enjoy the... the actual amp not completely breaking up, just on the clean side.
Okay.
Just so it's about to break, the amp's about to break up, and that's when I pump it from the front.
Yeah.
With my overdrive pedal, which stays on.
Yeah.
And then I control the clean dirt with my volume. So if I want to get cleaner, I just turn the volume down. I want to get more overdrive.
Yeah.
Turn it up. That's it.
And quickly, if you do not mind, take us through like your main pedals that you use a lot. Obviously, you've got quite a few, but it's like...
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a lot more because there's a Lili looper, which just loops some of the pedals in.
Oh, sick.
So they stay out of the mix.
Wow.
So I go into a Crybaby wah-wah pedal. Then it goes into a Barber Tone Press, which is a compressor. Just for a little extra boost or a little bit of compression on some, maybe some solos. And then it goes into my Tim pedal, which is an overdrive sort of it's not a mid push, it's not like a tube screamer, it's a little bit more flat frequency, which is basically my overdrive. It's not a heavy overdrive, it's a very medium overdrive. And that into MXR analog delay.
Oh, cool.
And that into the amp then. And then after that, I can bring in the Phase 90 phaser for some shimmery or Van Halen-y type phase effects. And then I've got my Octron fuzz octave pedal, which adds like a Moog sound.
Yeah,
if I want to take my middle guitar out and I just have the octaves there and a little bit of fuzz, it sounds like a Moog.
Yes.
It's one of those old 70s.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. I've got a Quint pedal which plays a fifth coming in the post.
Oh, nice.
At some stage I will, and hopefully that may end up on the pedal board, but that's pretty much it.
Thanks, man, Richard. That was really awesome. Is there anything else that you would like to say or get off your chest? Covered the ground?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. I think
you've
covered quite a bit of ground today.
I'm gonna go
physically as well.
I'm gonna go cover some more ground.
Yeah, I know. Good, man.
Cool.
Lekker interesting chat met Mr. Pryor. As jy 'n gitarist is, het jy definitief baie gehou van die laaste deel van die interview. Baie interessant hoe hy sy gitaar se nek is so swap en ag is net lekker altyd om met 'n ou te gesels wat passievol is oor 'n gitaar of oor watter instrument dan ook al. Dankie dat julle geluister het en bly ingetune want volgende week kom al vir jou nog 'n interessante gesprek. Lekker bly. Ask her why.